You're listening to KillRadio.org. We're interviewing Garrick Ruiz, L.A. activist, who recently got back from Palestine about a month ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you wanted to announce you're actually going to be giving a presentation about...
Wanted to let people know that I'm going to be speaking a week from tomorrow, Tuesday, October 22nd, at 7:30 p.m., it's a report back from my trip in Palestine, so I'll be talking about a lot of the same things I'm talking about in this interview, but also I have many pictures, slides that I'm going to be sharing at that talk. It's going to be at the Echo Park United Methodist Church, 1226 North Alvarado Street, just one block north of Sunset, and there is going to be Spanish translation available, so if you have Spanish-speaking friends, please invite them also.
Okay, and we'll repeat that towards the end of the interview if you didn't catch it, and I will post it on the Kill Radio site, and I'll post it on my own website. I'll plug that if you want to. We have actually, and if you wanted to read Garrick's email reports, we should have mentioned this earlier. Garrick, while he was in Palestine, sent back emails about his experiences, and I just went ahead and archived them on my website, straybulletins.com/Palestine. You've got probably at least two dozen live from the field reports from Garrick, and we've got there's probably about another dozen from Tamara Rettino, another LA activist who was also in the occupied territories. She was not in the same areas as Garrick, so it's a whole different perspective of what was going on. But during the break, Garrick wanted me to go back to the checkpoint issue because he wanted to clarify a few things. So
yeah, I just realized that I made sort of this broad statement that checkpoints are not a security measure, and just wanted to explain that statement a little bit. You know, I mentioned that people can get around them at various times, but it's this thing where with enough determination and a little bit of luck, people can actually, you know, get places within the West Bank. You know, even to other cities that are generally very difficult to get to. But, you know, often you'll talk to people and they'll be like, oh yeah, I came here from Nablus, you know, to Tulkarm or something, but in order to get here, I had to first, you know, walk, you know, 5 miles out of Nablus, catch a taxi in a village, you know, take that taxi up to a checkpoint, get out, cross the checkpoint on foot, get another taxi, you know, there's this whole, like, laundry list of different ways to, like, sort of get around checkpoints. But what it really does, and what a lot of people, I think, that were there with me at different points were talking about is that what there's, you know, people talk about collective punishment and you know, using other terms for things, but what the military is really doing with these checkpoints and all these other things is stealing time, we decided. They're mm-hmm. like, they're stealing away time in people's lives, right? So that something that should take 10 minutes now takes an hour. You know, something that should take an hour takes, you know, a day or two. And again, even in Jerusalem, for example, Jerusalem, where Palestinians are not allowed to go, any non-Jerusalem resident from the West Bank is not allowed into Jerusalem, but they're there all the time. like they can't stop them from getting into Jerusalem. It's an impossible thing. But again, it makes it very difficult. So, for example, I met someone who worked in a hotel in the old city of Jerusalem in the Christian quarter, and he lived in Ramallah, which is, you know, at most under, like, normal circumstances, I would say at most would be a 20-minute drive. It's something like 15 kilometers away from Jerusalem. But this, you know, this guy was telling me he has to leave his house at 5 a.m. in order to get to work, because it's such a complex process, and you have to, like, it's not like you just, you know, we think in terms of, oh, we wake up in the morning, we need to go somewhere, we go there. You know, I find that that's sort of the way I think about things. But in Palestine, it's very different. It's like you figure out, okay, where do I have to go? Okay, you call, you know, as many people as you can to find out, okay, what's the situation in this place? And then you figure out what the situation is all the way along the route to get there. And then as you're going, you're constantly talking to people, finding out, okay, where are their soldiers? Where is there a roadblock? Where is there, you know, a checkpoint right now? You know, and all these different things, so that it's like, like traveling becomes this, like, sort of, you just kind of have to have this, like, attitude of, like, well, we'll see what happens, because it's so, everything is so up in the air.
So it's almost like you need your own personal spy network to get anywhere.
Yeah, except that it's, you don't really, because, like, the spy network is Palestinian society. You know? It's like, that's one of the things, you know, in a, there's this guy, I don't understand how he does this for a living. There's this guy named, well, maybe I shouldn't say his name, but there's this guy in Tukaram who drives from Tukaram to the Kalandia checkpoint outside of Jerusalem and back every day. In a taxi, you know, he drives a taxi and he takes people. That's what he does for a living. And how he, I went that route with him twice, and how he can do that every day is beyond me. But you know, it's funny driving, because he goes to Kalandia, which is in between Ramallah and Jerusalem. And on the two times I went, we went in two totally different ways. And it was really funny because, as you know, you're going through these, like, sort of villages up in the mountains where there's not too much, like, military presence. And so he's driving through and he rolls down his window. And as he's driving through these villages, he slows way down and he's, like, talking to people out the window, you know, to find out, you know, what the situation is like, you know, what military presence is around, what's the best way to get to where he wants to go, et cetera, et cetera. It's really one of the things that stuck out to me about the Palestinians. I don't think it's unique to Palestinians. I think that it's a human trait, but Palestinians being in a such a horrifically oppressed position, you see the ways that they create alternate structures within society to deal with the fact that they're living under occupation. So this to me was one example of, like, it's like everybody is ready with sort of the traffic report, right? Like, everybody's like, oh, there's a checkpoint down this road, go this way, blah, blah, blah. Because in order for the society to function, people have to be able to get around these roadblocks and these checkpoints. And so there needs to be just sort of this broad network of people communicating that information. And so there is. They've created it.
So would you say that's actually sort of like a communications network, or do you think it's just sort of the people as a whole are a little bit more close-knit and a little friendlier because they have to rely on each other than, say, you know, like in the United States, a lot of parts of it?
I don't know how, you know, I'd say it's both, but I definitely think that in general, people are definitely more close-knit, you know, and it's not as if there are not problems within Palestinian society. There definitely are, but as far as comparing sort of the United States to Palestine, I mean, definitely people are much more, I think, aware of, you know, even, like, you know, you talk to politicians or you know, people with, rich people with more money, everybody's aware of what the issues are, you know? It's like, it doesn't, like, your position, your sort of class position in society does not, you know, it can have an effect on things, but a lot of times it doesn't really affect sort of the national struggle for national rights and you know, freedom and stuff.
Okay. We were talking a little earlier about confiscation of Palestinian property, but I've also read a lot of reports about just outright destruction and demolition of Palestinian property, mainly homes and orchards, which would be the one of their only sources of income. Could you talk about that a bit?
Sure. I'll talk about them separately just to try and keep myself on track here. I'll talk about home demolitions first, and I'll just kind of maybe go through a few of the different things I saw while I was there. Thousands of Palestinian homes have been demolished during the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Right now, however, it seems as though this is a particularly bad time in terms of home demolitions. They're happening at an extremely huge rate during this intifada, which has been going on for the past 2 years, the uprising, Palestinian uprising. And they happen all over. So it's kind of difficult to get everything organized in my mind, but because there's so many different situations in which homes are demolished. I'll talk about actually something from my first trip to Palestine in February. I was in a city called Rafah in the southern end of the Gaza Strip, which is sort of universally recognized to be the poorest city in Palestine, in a very, you know, sort of a list of very poor places. It's the poorest. And in February, there was a situation. One of the Islamic resistance movements is called Hamas. And in January, two fighters from Hamas managed to penetrate into Israel and attacked a military base and killed four soldiers before they themselves were killed. Now, whatever you want to talk about violence, you know, you can talk about nonviolence, you can talk about, you know, pacifism and things like this, and criticize it on that level, no question. But in terms of, you know, what it was a straight, like, paramilitary organization attacking the military. You know, in no way could you classify it as a terrorist attack, because it was directly attacking the forces of occupation, right?
Mm-hmm.
The response of the Israeli military was to go into Block O of the Rafah refugee camp and demolish somewhere between 70 and 90 homes. Just this huge area. And we went there a few weeks after it had happened. And it was just this, I mean, I can't even describe, just this sea of rubble, you know, that used to be people's houses. And one of the things that the military did was they said no one was living there.
Just 70 vacant homes sitting there.
In the middle of a refugee camp that's, you know, super densely populated, right?
Right.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you look at the... And they say that a lot about demolished homes, actually. And you go and you walk through the rubble of people's homes and you see clothes and you see school books and you see, you know, just, like, all the things that people need to live. Like, it's clear that people were living there. And we actually spoke about that instance in particular. We spoke with someone from the United Nations who told us, yeah, it's just absurd. And they know it's absurd, and they lie about it because they know they can. You know, she said, we went to the site, you know, I think she said 3 or 4 days after, somewhere between like half a week and a week afterwards, and we saw vegetables sprouting out of the rubble. Like, these were the vegetables that people had in their kitchens, like, to cook. Like, they were sprouting out of the rubble. And so just the whole idea that no one was living there was just truly absurd.
Well, on top of that, if this was a response to, you know, even if they wanted to call it a terrorist attack, how exactly does demolishing vacant homes save you?
Well, the idea, they said, was that they were creating a security zone along the border, right?
Right, the security rubble zone.
I'll talk maybe about one instance in Tulkarm, which I think illustrates a sort of different type of home demolition than that one. That's sort of the go into the refugee camp and just demolish a huge area type of home demolition, which happens sometimes, not that often. But in the West Bank right now, a lot of what they're doing is actually destroying particular homes, targeting particular homes. I arrived in Tulkarm on a Friday, and I don't remember the exact date. I remember it was a Friday. Woke up the next morning, Saturday morning, and one of the first things we heard was that a house had been demolished in the city last night. So during that day, we were able to go out and see what had happened and talk to some of the family members that had been living in that house. This was a two-story house, which meant that there was a family living upstairs and a family living downstairs. So two families were affected. The family living downstairs, one of the sons was wanted by Israel. Now, what exactly wanted means, you know, it's unclear what that means he's done. It could mean he's a member of an organization. It could mean that he's a fighter, that, like, he actually participates in armed struggle against the Israeli military. It could mean, or it could just mean that he's wanted and no one really knows why. All of those things are very common reasons for why they would want someone. But the fact that he was wanted meant that he was not in Israeli custody. He had not had a trial. He had not been convicted of any crime. He had not been accused of a crime. You know, maybe or charged with a crime, I should say. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe in their sort of reason for wanting him, they had a reason, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't, you know, it didn't go through any judicial process at all outside of the military. So there's nothing to say that this person was actually guilty of whatever it was that they said he was guilty of. They came to the house at about 1:30 a.m. This is all from talking with the father of this wanted man, mm-hmm. Who lived on the bottom story of the house. And he told us that, who didn't know where his son was, by the way, had no idea, because when people are wanted, they stay away. Like, they,
right.
they're underground. They came at about 1:30 in the morning, and they threw rocks at the door. That was how they woke him up, was by throwing rocks at the door. And he woke up and came to the door, and the soldiers told him, you have 15 minutes to get out of your house. We're gonna blow it up. You know, wake everyone up and get out. He said that after about 7 or 8 minutes, they started screaming at them, and eventually they had to get out in 10 minutes, so less even than they had actually said. So as you can imagine, in 10 minutes, you're not able to really get much of your belongings or anything like that out of the house. So most of their belongings were actually demolished, were, you know, amidst the rubble. They were forced to leave the house. The father, then, the one we were talking to, the soldiers forced him to go to all the other houses in the neighborhood and knock on the doors and wake everyone else up. So using him, very clearly using him as a human shield, right? Forcing him to do the work of the occupation
mm-hmm.
army. For fear of them being attacked because of what they were doing. Forced him to wake everyone up, and then they forced everyone in the immediate area, you know, to leave their houses and to go, I think it was a kilometer and a half away. And then they went inside, planted the explosives, and blew up the house later that night. And this was one of the, it was really actually a crazy experience, because we went to this house and talked to this man and to the father, actually, of the other family that was living in the house. And then a couple weeks later, we were at the TV station, the local TV station there in Tulkarm, and some of the guys there showed us video of that house being blown up, because there was a few hours in between when the soldiers got there and when they actually blew it up. So a camera person was actually able to get to a few blocks away and actually videotape the house, like, being blown up. And it was just It was really crazy to watch that. But so just to what I want to emphasize with the story is that, you know, what they're doing and what they state that they're doing is they're punishing people's families for their actions, right? For an individual does something or is alleged to do something, and the families are punished, right? This is happening in a lot of different ways. We also met with people that were exiled from the West Bank into the Gaza Strip for the same reason. Their brother was a fighter. You know, a lot of times they say we're doing this to suicide bombers and the houses of suicide bombers. They say that sort of in the media, and they do. And it's, in my opinion, still morally reprehensible to do that to the families of suicide bombers, because they're not the people that actually committed the crime, right? Mm-hmm. but they're doing it to lots of people that are not suicide bombers as well. And in this particular incident, they're not only punishing the family, right? They're punishing the family of this person. They're punishing this other family that lives upstairs. They're punishing everybody in a house that lives nearby or lives, I'd say, adjacent to, because when they blow up these houses, it doesn't just destroy the house. It damages every house near it, because the bricks fly outward and fly through other houses. And so you really see that this is a very clearly a form of collective punishment against an entire population. And it just boggles my mind how human beings can do this to other human beings.
Yeah. Let's move on. I'm realizing that we're starting to get towards the end of our time, but you spent some time working with the Red Crescent. Could you talk about some of that?
Sure. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society, throughout the sort of Islamic world, the Red Crescent is the equivalent of, like, the Red Cross in the United States, and the International Committee of the Red Cross is actually made up of Red Cross members and Red Crescent members. They're basically the same organization, but the Palestinian Red Crescent Society is the Palestinian incarnation of this international body. And in many places in Palestine, they have ambulances and are often responsible for transporting patients. They handle emergency cases and pick people up in emergency situations, but a lot of what they do is transporting patients from city to city when they need, you know, more specialized care, because there aren't so many really good hospitals, and so a lot of times, like, if you're in the north of the West Bank, if you're in Qarqilya or Tulkarm or Jenin, and you have serious medical problems, a lot of times you need to go to Nablus, where they have two big hospitals, or even Ramallah or Jerusalem, in order to get adequate treatment. And so the ambulances transport people, patients, in that way also. I worked with the Red Crescent in both Qarqilya and Tulkarm, and we, again, were operating off of the idea that having an international presence when there is a situation where you have to deal with the military, that it will ideally reduce the level of violence that occurs in these situations, and hopefully, in the case of ambulances, allow them to get to where they're going quicker than they otherwise would be able to. For probably about a month and a half between the two cities, we had internationals riding in the ambulances with the ambulance drivers, and it was really quite something to see how ambulances are treated. I actually highly recommend if people are able to check out some of my writings, because I wrote a lot about the ambulances, and again, that's at www.straybulletins.com/Palestine if people are interested in checking that out. But basically, ambulances are stopped all the time by the military. Again, maybe I'll just tell one story to try and illustrate the broader point. A particularly bad example to just show, you know, what people live through on a daily basis. When I was riding in ambulances in Qalqilya, I was doing an overnight shift. And at about 1 in the morning, maybe a little bit after, a call came in for someone in a village called Azun, outside of Qalqilya. Not very far, you know, maybe 5 miles, if that, outside. And so I rode with the ambulance that went there, and the call was an appendicitis. There was someone suffering from an appendicitis, so actually a very dangerous emergency case. And to make a long story short, the whole trip there and back to pick up this guy and bring him back to the hospital in Qalqilya took more than an hour and a half to go maximum 5 miles and back. We were stopped at the checkpoint outside of Qalqilya, and just to illustrate the level of like just uncaring that so many soldiers have, when ambulances come to this checkpoint in particular, I assume it's similar in other places, but this is the one I know firsthand. When the ambulances come up to this checkpoint at night, they sit there. They hit their siren, you know, and go woo, to let the soldiers know that they're there, and then they sit there and wait. And when I was stopped at night, it took anywhere, you know, I did, the longest we waited for the soldiers was 20 minutes. So the situation where you have an ambulance, very possibly serious emergency situation because it's the middle of the night, so there's no other reason for an ambulance to be out. And the soldiers just let them sit there at the checkpoint and don't come out. Finally, they come out. Then they spend, you know, 10 more minutes searching the ambulance, checking people's IDs, and then finally they let us through. Then we were stopped no more than 45 seconds after after we got through the checkpoint. I mean, seriously, like, it was as soon as we were out of view, a Jeep pulled us over and stopped us and once again searched the ambulance and eventually let us through, but again, you know, just delayed us further. Then we got onto the main road, and on the main road in between where we got on and the village of Azun, we were stopped again. And this time, this was one of the situations where the soldier, you know, one of the soldiers pointed a, it wasn't even an M16, it was some seriously heavy machine gun at my head, which is always a nice thing to have in the middle of the night. And, you know, made us all stand far away from the ambulance and lift our shirts to make sure we didn't have a bomb and all this different stuff. And eventually did also let us through. Finally, we got to the village. It's not actually to the village. It's to the gate along the road, which is closest to the village. And someone had driven him up to the gate in a civilian car. And then we transferred him into the ambulance and headed back to Qalqilya. On the way back, we were stopped again. Right before we got to the checkpoint, we were stopped again by two Jeeps. This time, we had a man in the back of the ambulance moaning and at times screaming from the pain he was in. And yet, the soldiers just would sit there. Like, this is what blew my mind maybe more than anything else about that trip. You know, it's one thing to stop an ambulance with no one in it. But when you have someone in the back who's, like, clearly, like, writhing in pain, like, in a lot of pain, and and making a lot of noise, and they just sat there and waited, you know. So if we give them that the security situation is such that ambulances need to be stopped and searched. So let's say we give them that, okay? They could stop the ambulance, search it, check him, make sure he doesn't have a gun on him or something, which he didn't, and no ambulance that I ever heard of had any kind of weaponry in it. Radio to the checkpoint, say, we just checked this ambulance, like, 200 meters from the checkpoint, and we're sending it on the way right now. Watch it. Make sure that no one jumps into it or something like that, mm-hmm. and let them through. But there's none of that. Those soldiers held us for about 5-10 minutes. Got to the checkpoint, had to sit and wait for another 10 minutes before they came out. And then they actually waved us through pretty quickly at that particular point because they'd seen us coming out and they let us back in. The same soldiers let us back in. But as I said, the whole thing took an hour and a half. The ambulance driver told me afterwards that basically his appendix could have ruptured at any point during that whole time, and if it had, he almost certainly would have died. Like, there would have, we don't have when there's a full-on appendix rupture, like, you need to be in a hospital, like, immediately. Right. And the medical equipment in the back of an ambulance just wouldn't have been enough for a situation like that, not to mention that there's no doctor, it's only an EMT.
Now, were there any situations that you were aware of that, like, an ambulance was outright refused passage through?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, wow.
All the time. in Tulkarm, there was a day when they just said, we're not letting any ambulances through the checkpoint today.
So if anybody on the other side of that checkpoint had an emergency or was seriously ill, they'd have to walk to the hospital or something?
Yeah, they just say, you know, orders. We can't let anyone through. And in Nablus probably more than anywhere else, that happened a lot. There were days when ambulances from Qalqilya went to Nablus and weren't allowed to leave again. So the drivers had to spend the night in Nablus at the hospital and come back the next day.
It's
bad, but at least it's not a situation where you have a patient that needs to go to the hospital that can't get there. And there were a lot of those as well. Tulkarm and Nablus, in particular, of the places I was in, ambulances often. I mean, just to tell you, like, the most horrific ambulance story I heard, March 17th was a really bad day for the city of Tulkarm. On that day, this year, March 17th, on that day, the Israeli military reoccupied the Tulkarm refugee camp. There are actually two refugee camps right outside the city, but the biggest one is called the Tulkarm refugee camp. And the military went in full force. If people have been following the situation at all, March and April were really the height of just killing and just military aggression in recent months anyway, probably during this intifada for the past 2 years. And on March 17th in Tulkarm, in the refugee camp, 17 people were killed by the military, including, I wasn't able to confirm this. I kept trying to confirm this. Like, people told me this, but I was never able to actually talk to someone who knew her name or anything like this. But supposedly a United Nations nurse was actually killed that day also in the refugee camp. But I wasn't able to confirm that, so I'm not absolutely positive about that fact. But supposedly the ambulance was going to pick up this nurse who'd already been killed, but they were going to pick up her body. But other people said they were just going to pick up bodies in the camp. And the International Committee of the Red Cross had actually negotiated with the Israeli Defense Forces for a Palestinian Red Crescent ambulance to go into the refugee camp and pick up the dead bodies that were lying in the street. And so the ambulance, driven by a man named Ibrahim, went to drive to the refugee camp, which is actually about 2 blocks away from the hospital. As the ambulance got about half a block away from the hospital, two tanks came from the other direction towards the ambulance. The ambulance stopped. They opened fire with machine guns on the ambulance. Sophia, who I knew, was also in the ambulance. She was another one of the workers at the Red Crescent. Was injured. She was shot in the arm. The driver, Ibrahim, was shot in the leg while he was in the ambulance. He got out and attempted to run to safety behind a building, And as he was running to safety, the tank shot him down with a machine gun and killed him. So in Tulkarm, it's a city. The city and the surrounding area, about 150,000 people. At this point, they have two ambulances. during March, one was destroyed by a rocket fired from an Apache. Two were destroyed by tanks, one being the one that Ibrahim was in. And I think another one was out of commission because of just a regular car accident that didn't have anything to do with the military. And so they were down to two ambulances for this huge population. It just was just the idea of a tank attacking an ambulance, just blew me away. I can't even imagine that.
Mm. Well, and that has me wondering a little bit about sort of the behavior of soldiers, because you say that a deal was negotiated with the defense forces for the ambulance to go, and yet they open fired. So to what extent is this repression sort of government policy versus, I guess part of me even wonders if a lot of it is just a show to convince the Israeli citizens that they're doing something to fight terrorism versus just sadism on the part of the individual soldiers?
I mean, it seems, and all of this is conjecture, right? It's just
sure,
from
sure.
What I'm...
You're not a member of the Israeli government, you can't say.
But it seems like that soldiers, at least on the sort of, I don't know, squad level or whatever, you know, small groups of them,
mm-hmm.
have actually a lot of autonomy on what they do. And so that's part of the reason why the occupation is so random, is because soldiers are different.
Okay.
And so they treat people differently, and they act differently, and they do things differently. A lot of the thing, I think there's also a degree of the higher ups in the military, though, trying to point to that and say that, sort of, we can't control our individual soldiers type things,
mm-hmm.
of all the atrocities that they commit, right? So in Ramallah in March, the looting and just outright theft money, cash and valuables and business, equipment and offices and different things, the outright just theft by soldiers was just massive. I mean, I've heard someone told me that the estimate was that $1 billion worth of combination, $1 billion worth of damage and theft happened in Ramallah, which seems like an awful lot to me, but that was one estimate I heard. But there was widespread looting in March by the soldiers, and it's clear that this could not have happened without a policy decision at a high level to at least allow it to happen, right? It may not be that there was an order that said, loot Ramallah. But there may have been it seems like what's more likely is that, the commanders were just given instructions to say, if your soldiers want to do this, let them do it. And that, in a lot of cases, that seems to be the way things work, is a lot of looking the other way.
Okay. Well, we're actually getting drawn to a close here. We got about 5 minutes left in the show, but if I'm just going to open it up, anything you feel that what are the things you want us to know, that you want people listening to know, what you think people could do if this is a situation that concerns them? And I certainly hope it is. I hope you couldn't listen to all this and think, whatever. But,
Well, I think, the thing I really want to reiterate, if I haven't done it enough, is how integral the United States is to this occupation. That if it weren't for the United States, this could not be happening. when you just look at the weapons that are used, you know, practically every soldier has an M16 made in the United States. The helicopters, a lot of the helicopters they use Apache helicopters and Cobra helicopters, both manufactured in the United States. They use F-16 fighter bomber planes manufactured in the United States. They use tear gas. All of the tear gas used is manufactured in the United States. The vast majority of ammunition they use is manufactured in the United States. The tanks, a lot of them are actually manufactured in Israel, but they use parts from Germany and the United States and other places. And so in particular, without the United States and the massive military aid and just general foreign aid that goes to Israel, this could not be happening. Just to give you some perspective, no country in the world receives more foreign aid from the United States than Israel. And actually, no state in the United States receives as much money from the U.S. federal government as Israel does.
Really?
Not only, so you have a situation where the United States is pouring money into Israel more than anywhere else in the world. And just to keep in mind, this is, I forget, it's either the 15th or the 16th richest country in the world per capita. I mean, this is not a poor country. This is a very wealthy country as far as world standards go, that we're pouring all this money into. And it has the fifth largest military on the planet. So it's this issue of, like, you know, do we really need, like, is Israel really going to be wiped off the face of the planet tomorrow if we stop sending them F-16s, you know? And the reality is, no, it's not. And they have a lot of weapons already. They don't need more. And they have, it's very clear the military in Israel is able to defeat any combination of Arab countries. Their military is stronger than the 22 Arab countries put together. And so the idea that we need to prop up this, like, sort of flailing, you know, country is just absurd. And so I would just want to reiterate the connection between the United States and Israel and the really intimate connection that we all have with our tax dollars to this occupation. In terms of what people can do, there are a few things. One is, and it's funny because it's not actually specifically about Palestine, but I would just recommend people do anything that they possibly can right now to stop the war with Iraq. Because it may not seem like it's directly going to affect Palestine, but Palestinians are extremely scared because they think that when that war happens, that Israel is going to, like, let loose. Because there won't be as many people watching what Israel does. And people are very scared, particularly about an invasion of the Gaza Strip and about ethnic cleansing beginning in certain parts of the West Bank.
Yeah, that happened with Afghanistan, I believe, that once the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, Israel cracked down hard. And because, you know, American point of view was looking at Afghanistan and wasn't looking at Israel anymore, and Israel kind of snuck in and did some real damage.
That's correct. Both right after September 11th had happened, and then when the bombing started in Afghanistan. Mm. In terms of concrete things people can do, I mean, I would recommend, you know, I don't always think that this is the most effective thing, but I really think it's important for people to try to talk to their elected officials, right? I don't think that the sort of current state of U.S. democracy is the ideal. But at least we have some ability to communicate with our elected representatives, which is not the case for Palestinians who do not have elected representatives who are subjects of another country. I would recommend that for people who have the ability to try to get to Palestine and to see things for yourself. That's really, in talking to Palestinians, that's really what they want. Not necessarily for people to come to Palestine, although they love their guests, let me tell you. But what they really want is for the real story of what's happening to get out to the world. And they're not under the illusion that, like, you know, even if popular opinion in the United States was pro-Palestinian, that would necessarily change the government, as we can see with this war against Iraq, for example, which is massively unpopular. But they feel like that's their main card to play. It's like that hopefully world population, you know, the world, and in general world popular sentiment is definitely pro-Palestinian, but in particular in places like Europe and the United States, the sort of power centers in the world, that if the populations hear what's happening, that they will not be able to stand the human rights violations and will attempt to change the policies of their governments towards Israel. And so I'd highly recommend people going, if they can, to see for themselves and coming back and talking to people about it like I'm trying to do, because it's not happening through the mainstream media in this country, and so we need to really take as I think is one of the sort of philosophies of Kill Radio and definitely the Independent Media Center, that you do, like, news isn't something that's only for reporters, right? You do it yourself.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so if somebody did want to go to Palestine, I'm going to guess that not too many listeners are going to volunteer to go to a war zone, but if they did, International Solidarity Movement is a good way to go through them, possibly?
Yeah, I'd highly recommend it. They have different campaigns, actually. There's a campaign that just started around olive picking, which I realize you asked me about and I never got to. But
we only got to
alas, but around trying to accompany farmers to their fields to pick olives, which unfortunately can sometimes be a sort of taking your life in your hands kind of action. And the website for the International Solidarity Movement is www.palsolidarity.org. That's PALSOLIDARITY.org, and it's all one word.
Okay, and what are some other good information sources, would you say, for information about Palestine and Israel and the occupied territories?
I'll give you the book I'm reading right now because I think it's really excellent. If anyone has, it may be hard to find, but there's a book called Palestine by Joe Sacco.
Oh, I actually have that.
It's a comic book, actually. And it's kind of, you know, it's 10 years ago, so the information is somewhat out of date, but a lot of it is really, like, I've been reading it since I got back, and I'm just like, wow, he did just a really good job of capturing what life is like there. And it's a comic book, so it's actually, I feel, gives a much better sense of, like, life than, say, an intellectual, sort of book does. But I'd recommend that. I'd recommend the ZNet site, which has a lot of different things, but it also has a section on the Middle East, which I think is www.zmag.org, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of different websites and other things out there. I believe the PAL Solidarity site has a number of different links that will help people find more information.
Okay, and then we've got your reports back from Palestine while you were there at the straybulletins.com/Palestine. And you're going to be actually giving a presentation at the Echo Park United Methodist Church October 22nd, 7:30 p.m. I'm reading a flyer, if you can't tell, folks. 1226 North Alvarado Street, one block north of Sunset. And if you want more information on that, you can call 626-284-7116. Or if somebody wants to email you, do you have an email address?
Yeah, my email address, if people want to get in touch with me, is grok@riseup.net. grok@riseup.net.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm shaking his hand, although you can't see that, but... I think it's just you've done a great thing. You're a hell of a lot braver than I will probably ever be in going. And I know that you help people. And you went over there, you helped out real-life people and help people over here see what's going on. So, yeah, we're going to be signing off. It's the end of the program today, the Lying Media Bastard Show. Our radio IMC should be starting shortly. And, yes, thank you very much. I'll be back next week talking more about how the media is evil, and how war things are bad, too. Talk to you all later.